The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Over the weekend, the United States published its new National Security Strategy, a document that is usually published once in every administration, and it usually includes grand language on cooperation with allies. But this version strikes a remarkably different tone, warning that Europe faces civilizational erasure and that migration policies are creating strife across the world. Now, joining us to look at the document in more detail is David Dunn, Professor of International Politics at the University of Birmingham. David, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, first of all, can you bring us some of the headlines from this? Because my superficial reading of it, it just strikes me as a racist document, front and central.
It certainly has those undertones, in fact, overtones. It talks about how, on that point, in 20 years' time, Europe might be majority non-European. Presumably that means non-white and non-Christian. So the language is clearly racist. A civilizational erasure, again, hints at that notion that there's one particular view of European that they have in mind when they're talking about Europe. But fundamentally, what this is a statement of a rejection of America's role in the world over the last 80 years. What America has been about, previous versions of this document have talked about how America is stronger working with like-minded allies who shared the same values, who actually promoted democracy, promoted human rights and liberalism around the world. And what this says is we're ditching all of that. We're focusing on Latin America and making money for American corporations. And you can read also making money for the Trump family, because that's been a feature of the last year of the way in which they've actually practiced their diplomacy by bullying allies, by putting trade tariffs on people, getting concessions, and concessions often for the Trump corporation as much as for American businesses.
Now, the question of how much Trump is truly the author of this strategy, I mean, when he is interviewed on the occasions when interviews actually are allowed to take place, not shouting against the background of Marine One or on Air Force One, he's asked questions and he simply doesn't appear to know, for example, who he has pardoned and what they might have done. So you've got the impression that there are people behind him who are the architects of all of this stuff. And Trump, as long as there's, greenbacks for him and his family, he goes along with pretty much anything that is suggested to him. So who are the real architects?
Yeah, well, I mean, just on the first point, I mean, Trump is someone who is famously very lazy. He watches TV. He doesn't read things. He has no attention to detail. He doesn't know detail. And therefore, it is others. So what this document bears the mark of is J.D. Vance, his comments in Munich in February, castigating Europeans, praising the AfD in Germany and other right-wing anti-democratic parties in Europe is clearly an influence on this document. But Stephen Miller, his deputy chief of staff, whose views are to the right of most people in Europe, and more, even to the right of most European right-wing parties, is clearly at play here. And we see notions of the great replacement theory, the concern about migration. It's sort of an ethno-nationalist, as you say, racist understanding of what America's interests should be, about promoting a particular agenda of whiteness. I mean, the whole idea of trying to actually remove millions of Mexicans or Latin Americans from the United States is about that idea of racial purity. I mean, Trump himself even talked about how these immigrants are poisoning our blood. I mean, this is talk from the 1930s, but it's a feature of the way in which this administration sees the world, unfortunately.
And of course, he referred to Somalis as garbage last week. So this is who is in charge of America at the moment. It's racist in the extreme, though, because if you look at his own missus, for example, from Eastern Europe, when you look at Italians and Greeks and Irish and English and Scottish, his own heritage being German and Scottish, it's okay if they're aliens as long as they're white. That seems to, even the white South Africans that he's allowing in, not black South Africans, everything is basically racist. And yet Trump would have said in his earlier years that, when he was a Democrat, by the way, that he had lots of friends who were black. He didn't discriminate against black people. He would even say now he's lots of people of color working in Mar-a-Lago.
Well, yeah, the people working in Mar-a-Lago are doing all the service jobs. He has famously employed lots of Latin Americans in his construction companies, often on dodgy contracts. But he, as an old man, he's 79, seems to have got much more racist as he has got older, and that is at play. Unfortunately, it's a tone that has resonated with a lot of Americans in the last election. I think it's a mistake to see this as a just about Trump. The problem isn't, as far as our European perspective, isn't just Trump. The problem is now America. America have voted to board the Titanic twice, knowing what the first time was. I mean, you know, this guy was re-elected, and people knowing where he was coming from, and he sees his re-election as a license to be even more extreme, to be untamed, to be unfettered in pushing through his prejudices, and that is what we're seeing laid out in this document. What is most worrying is that this is where we've got to in less than a year. There's three more years of this. We can expect much more of this sort of extremism, this sort of leverage, this sort of pressure, this sort of agenda coming from the Trump White House. And the issue is, how do we respond to it?
Now, the question of the brakes that normally would apply to a president out of control would be Congress and the Supreme Court. And he loaded the Supreme Court with conservatives. And you wonder, I mean, they gave him the nod over the Texas redistribution of seats just before the weekend. You wonder how far the Supreme Court will allow him to go before they end up in some sort of conflict with him, which really constitutionally they have to win. And if they don't, well, it's the end of the American system.
Well, I think what we have is a very different constitutional setup already, because what's happened is that things that we expected, for example, that fiddling the elections in Texas to allow the Republicans to win, you would think the courts would uphold that. They have in the past, but the Supreme Court on this issue and on so many other issues have given in to presidential authority. So what's happening over the last 9 months has been a rebalancing of the Constitution to give more and more power to the executive, and an executive that seems to want to rule like a king in a court. He ignores Congress. Most presidents will bring legislation before Congress. What he's done is issue executive orders and actually just issue fiats, irrespective of the law, in contradiction to the law, and the law is trying to play catch-up. Where the law tries to play catch-up, the Supreme Court overturns the existing law. So what you have is a supine court system. You have a supine Congress that actually is emasculated because they're frightened of him, because he threatens to use vast amounts of money from various billionaires to unseat them through the primary process, and therefore they are effectively emasculated, and therefore he is able to rule like no other president really, and well, certainly not in the last 100 years. And what you have instead is him just pushing the boundaries at every opportunity. Now, there is an opportunity at the midterm elections in November, but staggeringly, if you look at the opinion polls, the Democrats are as unpopular as the Republicans. The opinion polls, although he has got the worst opinion polls ever, there's still 40% of the population of America that think he is wonderful. The problem isn't just Trump. The problem is now this new version of America.
Now, the question then of winning the midterms, whoever does it, I mean, you say the Democrats are as unpopular as the Republicans, or as popular, depending on how you like to characterize it. But the old line, for a football team, if you lose the dressing room, you've little chance of winning the match. And there is a sense that maybe if the dressing room is MAGA and other floating voters, if you lose them, you lose the match. And the Democrats really don't have to do that much except pick the right candidates, and they will thrive.
Yeah, I mean, there is that prospect, and they did that in the off-year elections in Virginia and in New Jersey, and they picked the right candidate for New York, and the opinion polls have swung in their favor. There was an off-year election about a week ago where there was a 9% swing to the Democratic Party, and if they push the issue of affordability, that seems to resonate, and hopefully in the midterm elections in November, they will make some ground, because most North Americans are feeling the cost of living crisis. But there's a broader question here, which is that their constitutional settlement has been unpicked, that what it is to be an American democracy, what it is to have the rule of law, what it is to lead in the world, are all being undermined by this administration that is reversing 250 years of American politics, or certainly the last 80 years of American politics. And that doesn't seem to resonate with huge parts of the American electorate. And that's a worrying situation.
Going back to the document itself, there was one part that I think that where there was a point to be made. The claim that Europe has a lack of self-confidence in its relationship with Russia. In other words, when you look at the prowess of Europe collectively, that there's no question that Russia could not overrun Europe. Parts of it, maybe the Baltics, who knows, but basically that Europe is actually much stronger than Russia and the Russian economy, and yet Europe collectively does not assert that confidence.
And here's the irony. I mean, one of the things that the way in which NATO has, America has run the NATO alliance is that it's actually actively prevented Europe coming together as Europe, because the Americans didn't want the Europeans to duplicate or interfere with American leadership of the alliance. And now they turn around and say, you're useless by yourself. And that the issue of European capacity is a problematic one, because yes, Russia has the economy the size of Italy, the GDP of Europe collectively is huge compared to that of Russia. But actually making that militarily effective, making that a decision-making body that could actually agree on how to respond to Russia is the difficulty. And therefore the division and the way in which Europe has been the subordinate partner to America in NATO means that actually Europe is not prepared to defend itself militarily against a much more determined and much more prepared Russian threat. And that's partly why you have the Europeans not being willing to criticize and respond to criticism from the Trump administration, because they recognize the dependence that they have on American military guarantees to European security that they need in the face of a Russian thing. So we have, so Europe is in a huge problem. We have an aggressive Russia on one side and defecting, rejecting, abdicating leadership from America on the other side, and a difficulty of the Europeans to get their act together to fill that gap in the short term.
Now, there has been dismay expressed by various European leaders, various politicians, about this document. I mean, they're quite dismissive of it in terms of how it was written and how it was constructed, how contradictory it is, how naive it is.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, it's the post-41 version, 1941 version of America, is that it sees the world in strategic terms and geostrategic terms, and sees the geostrategic threats to itself. So therefore, every one of these previous statements talks about the threat from Russia, the threat from China, and the need to engage with allies as a way of protecting the boundaries of freedom. You know, that's the rhetoric you normally expect. What you have here is, now Latin America is much more important than anywhere else. We need to think about migration, about drugs, about winning contracts in Latin America and keeping Chinese firms out. It's incredibly narrowly focused. It's a sort of an 1820s view of the world rather than a 21st century view of the world. So there's that naivety, that lack of strategic vision. It's all about a very narrow vision about making money for America rather than actually America's role in the world. And that's a huge change and a huge problem.
David Dunn, Professor of International Politics at the University of Birmingham, thank you very much.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.